This is Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sitterick. And we start today with what prosecutors are calling the largest college admission scam ever. More than 50 people have been charged in a scheme allegedly run by California businessman William Rick Singer. He's accused of conspiring with exam administrators and college coaches to help 33 parents lie, bribe, and cheat their children's way into elite universities around the country. At a press conference yesterday, Joe Bonalata, special agent in charge of the FBI Boston Division, decried the parents allegedly involved in the scheme.
Make no mistake, this is not a case where parents were acting in the best interests of their children. This is a case where they flaunted their wealth, sparing no expense, to cheat the system so they could set their children up for success with the best education money could buy, literally. Their actions were, without a doubt, insidious, selfish, and shameful.
And joining me now to talk about those alleged actions and the fallout since this investigation was announced yesterday afternoon is WBUR's Carrie Young. Hi, Carrie.
Good afternoon.
And listeners, we will be turning to you on this as well in just a couple of minutes. Are you a parent? How does this scandal make you feel about your children applying to college? Is this just a tabloid story, or is this a sign of deeper issues in how we think about college admissions? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Carrie, for those who might be just coming on board to this story, can you explain the scandal? What did the prosecutors lay out yesterday?
Yeah, well, like you were mentioning earlier, this is a really complex scam that was led in a large part by William Rick Singer. And he was the founder of this college admissions consultant company called Edge College and Career Network. And now, basically, he was selling two types of services to families and pretty much guaranteeing that they would get into the college that they wanted their child to get into. That was twofold. One of the ways was through inflating standardized test scores in various methods he had. And then the other way was manipulating the system around recruited athletes and getting them in that avenue.
You mentioned some various methods. I was reading through the complaint. There are some really staggering details in here. Can you tell us kind of how this scheme worked, really?
Yeah, there were a lot of logistics involved in all of this. So first with the testing, there were a couple of ways that they went about inflating those test scores. And so for one, a child would go in, or the student, I guess it would be a teenager at this point, but the student would go in, they would take the test, and then the proctor, who would be paid off, would then update the answers, basically with more right answers, and kind of decide on a score that they felt would be good enough to get into the school. Then the other way that this happened was someone would just go in and pretend to be that particular student. So they're, you know, with the SAT scores and the ACT scores, a lot of logistics involved. But then there was the other sort of way of gaming or getting in the admission system through the athletics department. And that involved bribes of coaches at several of these colleges like Wake Forest, Yale, Georgetown, Stanford were some of the colleges named. And basically it was, you know, they were painting these students to have more athletic ability than they had. Some of that even involved faking websites, pictures that were photoshopped. They went a long way to really sell these athletic abilities that weren't actually there.
Unbelievable. I know you've been talking with universities and admissions offices today. What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, so the admissions officers, at least, that I spoke with, you know, they were saying there is, in their opinion, a pretty robust system that they've been working with for a long time to really ensure that that people are being truthful in their admissions materials. I spoke with Ed Boland. Now, he was the director of admissions or the assistant director of admissions at Yale University in the late 80s, so a little while ago. But based on a few other conversations I've had, this system is pretty much still in use at other colleges. But when you're verifying or trying to see if someone's being truthful in admissions, it's sort of based on the system of patterns. So do those SAT scores jive with the transcripts and the English grades that you have? Does that jive with the essay quality that you got and the recommendations? Here's kind of how he described it when something doesn't seem quite right.
What often raises a red flag is when you feel like you're getting a sense of a different student from different sources. You're looking through for a through line. You're looking through people saying consistent things about a student.
And so he says when there is that red flag, then that's when calls go out to guidance counselors or the schools. Those fact-checking sort of steps start getting made.
And what about people who are more connected to admissions offices currently?
Well, the admissions, like the admissions counselors, I guess, that I've spoken with also, they say that that system still pretty much holds up. That's the system that they've heard of as far as the counselors go. And even some of the people who have come from admissions offices in the last few years, they say, you know, you really can see and detect a lot of potential fraud just by making sure everything matches up.
So folks who you've been talking to, I know you've been talking to a wide range of people on this, do they see this as kind of the exception to the rule, or is this, do you think this is kind of the tip of the iceberg, we're going to see more of this type of thing?
Most people are telling me this really is the exception to the rule. This was a bad apple that came out in this case. But one thing that I did hear in some of my conversations, I talked with Casey Neer. She's the executive director of counseling at CollegeWise in Newton. And she says, as far as like the bigger picture that this paints for the college admissions environment, is for her, it was just kind of staggering as to see how far you could go with gaming the system. Here's how she described it to me.
Higher education has a lot of issues, and that it is not a meritocracy, and that it is not fair and balanced. But I was pretty shocked at the volume of information I think that this case seems to have collected, and the ways in which these people were able to get influence were through very different channels than has ever happened before, which kind of shows the range and ability to corrupt the process.
Now, for Neer, the thing that really struck her was the fact that these athletic departments were being used as another avenue to get in, and yet that was another avenue that has been breached in this.
Well, that's WBUR reporter Carrie Young. Carrie, thanks so much for the update. Appreciate
You're welcome.
It. I'd like to bring in a couple more voices on this story. We're joined in studio by Natasha Waraku. She's an associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Natasha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me.
And we're also joined via Skype by Maria Lascaris. She's a senior private counselor at Top Tier Admissions and was previously the director of admissions and also the dean of admissions and financial aid at Dartmouth College. Maria, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And listeners, don't forget, we want to hear from you on this as well. Are you a parent? How does this scandal make you feel about your children applying to college? Is it just a tabloid story with celebrities, or do you think it's a sign of deeper issues in our college admissions process? You can call us 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Natasha, I'd like to start with you. I know you've done a lot of research in this area. Why do you think this story has kind of captivated the whole country basically right now?
Yeah, it's interesting to me. I think that, you know, part of the issue here is that these, you know, elite selective universities have a lot of, you know, symbolic meaning in American society. We see them as the kind of pinnacle of our meritocracy, and they're symbolic of our idea of equal opportunity. You know, this idea that if you work really hard and you put your head down and get good grades, you too can get into Harvard and Yale and USC and Wake Forest. And so, you know, because we place so much more faith in meritocracy in the United States, and by the way, more than, you know, other wealthy countries, then I think that these universities prop up that idea. So when you see this very blatant, literally like people paying for their spots, I think that calls that into question, and it gets people really upset.
Maria, you've had experience working in an admissions office at an Ivy League school. What's your reaction seeing this story break?
Sure. So I'm very stunned. When I heard the news yesterday, and I've been reading the various accounts and trying to understand the charges and what happened. And like Natasha, you know, understand that for so many in the United States and around the world, you know, the opportunity to go to a college or university is seen as a worthwhile aspiration that students aspire to. And as parents, you know, we want the very best for our children and want to give them the opportunity to better themselves by going on to a great college or university. So, but, you know, bottom line, it was pretty shocking to hear the story and to realize the depth of fraud and deception that this individual has been alleged to undertake, and all the people that were participating in it with him.
So I want to play a little bit of tape from U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling's press conference yesterday. He made a pretty interesting distinction. Let's take a listen.
The parents charged today, despite already being able to give their children every legitimate advantage in the college admissions game, instead chose to corrupt and illegally manipulate the system for their benefit. We're not talking about donating a building so that a school's more likely to take your son or daughter. We're talking about deception and fraud.
And I want to bring in a caller here who I think is going to further that point. Cooper from Weymouth, you're on the line. Welcome to Radio Boston, Cooper.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, that's the exact quote that sparked my question, which is, you know, you're talking about gaming the system. Why is, you know, things like legacy admissions or, you know, as that said, donating millions of dollars for a building, why is that legitimate?
So it's a great question, Cooper. Thanks so much for the call. Natasha, I want to start with you on that. I was pretty blown away when I hear Lelling just so offhandedly say, this is not just, you know, donating a building, as if that's a legitimate way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the distinction that he's making is a very interesting one, right? One of these is illegal and is not defended by universities. And the other is actually legal. And the universities say that they do that and they will defend their right to do that. And, you know, many, many Americans, I think, will question, well, is that fair and is that not fair? And I think that's a legitimate question. But you know, we can think about other less kind of crazy things like, you know, legacy admissions, athletic recruiting, even paying for your child to get SAT tutoring. There are a lot of things that wealthy parents are able to do for their children to help them that more disadvantaged parents are not able to do.
Yeah, I think that's been one of the interesting conversations coming out of this is, while this story is so outrageous when you're seeing some of the details that are playing out, that systemically there are some of these issues that are already kind of creating this disparity in higher education. Maria, what's your reaction hearing Attorney Lelling kind of talking about that idea of, well, it's not like they're just donating a building. This is way beyond that.
Sure. Well, I think it is way beyond that. Obviously, one is a crime and the other is not. I think the universities obviously have a variety of values and aspirations. And so, you know, private universities have set up these processes and these different offices to support the goals of the institution. But I think there's a very bright line between the work of the advancement office, the development staff, and the admissions office. I think at no time is a development officer saying to a prospective family, hey, if you donate this building, that's a surefire way to get your kid into college. So I think, I believe from my experience, there's a great deal of integrity at both sides of the institution when it comes to the people that are making the decisions to admit students to the university, and then those who are tasked with helping the institution achieve its goals through the sort of development and philanthropic work. So there is, I think, a clear separation between those two entities, although, you know, it's easy in an offhand comment for folks to think that there's a quid pro quo going on. And in my experience, there isn't a quid pro quo.
Well, Natasha, let me bring you in on this because you've done research into this sort of issue. Does that jive? Do you think that there's a clear separation?
I think that there is a clear separation between these offices. I think, you know, if you are a failing student, a very low achieving student, you know, no amount of financial donation is going to get you in. But I do think that it gives you a leg up. And in these places where it is very hard, you know, a lot of amazing young people are not getting in, you know, that donation to the university is going to get you in. And I think, you know, these are elite universities need to really think hard about what they are teaching students and how they are defining who is worthy and not worthy. Because the reality is that, you know, we take admission, you know, where you go to college, where did your child get into college, where did you get, as a real marker of worthiness. And so in allowing families to do these kinds of things and deploy their financial resources, you know, even if it gives you a leg up, not just, you know, a foot in the door, I think it's problematic because it is creating different signals, and it's privileging already privileged families.
So I want to go back to the phones here. Elsa from Southborough. Welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind, Elsa?
Hi there. I am a current high school senior, from Southborough, and I'm waiting for my results from colleges to come in the next 2 weeks. And I applied to several schools that are involved in this scandal, such as USC. And I just wanted to comment on how seemingly unfair it is for students who have worked really hard for 12 years to not get a spot in favor of someone who relied on their parents to call in a favor, and what it means for students that are both hearing back from colleges now and in the future, and what it will do for the college admissions process as a whole.
Yeah, Elsa, thank you so much for the call. I'm curious kind of how you'd respond to that. How do we maintain kind of faith in the system when someone like Elsa is seeing this clearly unfair situation play out?
Yeah, I think, you know, what I would say to you, Elsa, is that, again, the where you go to college is not the be-all, end-all of the future. And I think that, you know, beyond this, you know, these are small numbers of people who've done this, again, this egregious way of getting into college. But there are other ways in which privilege does affect your ability to get into these colleges. And I think we have to recognize that there are so many amazing young people in the United States, so many who deserve an excellent education. I mean, I would argue all 18-year-olds deserve to go to an excellent college and have excellent opportunities. But there's more than we have than these places have space for, and we need to recognize that in society.
Yeah, and I want to address something that you brought up earlier, Natasha, and that's this idea of legacy students. That's another kind of tangent to this story. We actually had at that time incoming Harvard President Larry Bacow on Radio Boston back in June, and here's what he said about legacy students.
As a group, the legacies are an extraordinarily accomplished group of applicants who, independent of the admissions process and how it selects them, have a leg up because they know and they understand the institution, and they know and understand what it takes to thrive and succeed at the institution. So their applications tend to be, you know, well put together. They have deep knowledge of the institution. So it's a self-selected pool, which as a group, by almost any metric, looks very, very good relative to the broader applicant pool.
He went on to basically explain that if it's a toss-up situation, they will go with the legacy student because of the connection to the university and work to promote the university and the community. Maria, I'm curious in your experience how legacy students were kind of considered in the admissions process, and do you see a certain unfairness in that?
Well, similar to what President Bacow said, you know, I think there is the sort of immediate reaction that somehow the legacy students are not strong students to begin with, haven't done well in school, haven't been deeply involved in their communities, haven't been engaged in activities, whether in school or out of school, to help them, you know, develop whatever their interests or talents are. So I think right away that question sort of suggests that the students maybe aren't strong students to begin with. And in my experience, the students very much were on par with the other applicants in the pool.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting they're not strong students. I am curious, though. He uses things like they know their applications tend to be well put together. I mean, that implies an institutional knowledge that your average applicant is not going to have. And do you see that at all as an unfair advantage?
Well, I think the students obviously would know more about their parents' alma mater. Probably they've heard their parents talk about, you know, their undergraduate experiences. They may have visited the campus more. They may be more familiar with what a Harvard or a Dartmouth offers. And so they are able to potentially speak with more firsthand knowledge about, you know, why a particular school would be a good fit. But I think, you know, that in and of itself, I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. You know, they've done some extra research. They've had the opportunity to visit. But other students who aren't legacies at these same institutions have also had the opportunity, whether through an in-person visit or a virtual visit or, you know, working with their high school college counselor, to really understand, you know, what are the opportunities offered and why those would be good for me as a prospective college student.
Natasha, what do you make of legacy students?
Yeah, I mean, I buy that. I think that, you know, because of the privileges that legacy students have, they are more likely to be very strong candidates, right? They have a lot of privilege that they're getting from their parents. And so I think that's true. And we also know that at a place like Harvard, most legacy applicants are not getting in, right? So it's not like you're a legacy, you automatically get in. On the other hand, in these super competitive places, you know, the most elite colleges are accepting 1 in 20 applicants. They reject so many amazing young people every year because there's just not space, that it is a process that is unfair. You're taking students who are already privileged and giving them a little bit of a boost. And that is enough to make the difference between getting in and not getting in. And that is a process that increases inequality in who ends up on these campuses rather than decreases it.
Maria, I'm curious, in your work at an Ivy League admissions office, did you see applicants that you recognized were fraudulent or stretching the truth? How did you guys go about verifying kind of what students are telling you?
Certainly, and similar to what I believe Ed Boland had shared that sort of began this segment, you look for patterns in an application. So, for instance, just using some of the information that came out recently about Singer and creating these athletic profiles of students who were these fantastic rowers or track stars or water polo players, you know, one of the first things that you look for as you're reading an application is you are looking for themes and patterns that probably are established in the students' own part of the application, their essays, their extracurricular activities, and you're looking for a through line as you get to the letters of recommendation, the transcript, a campus interview, anything else, you know, that's part of that application. So, you know, one of the first questions I had in thinking about the news from yesterday was, you know, these students for whom they created these athletic profiles, what did the teachers say? Did the teachers talk about them being star athletes when, in fact, these kids were not star athletes? So I think, you know, the challenge perhaps of these places that don't run a holistic admissions process, or maybe if there's 100,000 applications, you know, maybe the reading process isn't as well developed to spot these. But I think, you know, certainly at Dartmouth, we had a very thorough reading process, a thorough evaluation process, and it would raise a flag if,
I mean, some of the schools we're talking about,
one part of the application talked about a student being a fabulous athlete, but nobody else mentioned that. And one, it would raise a red flag.
The schools we're talking about are, you know, considered the quote unquote elite schools of the country. Yale is one of the schools implicated.
Yeah.
I'm curious, do you think that it's possible that you can't speculate, but how could they not have seen this? Basically, is I think a question a lot of people are asking right now.
Yeah. It's hard to know with something like, you know, being a star soccer player. Again, if nothing else in that student's application talks about being a star soccer player, it is a bit of a head scratcher.
I mean, I was reading through the complaint, and one student went in for orientation at USC, and they asked him, "Oh, so you're a track star?" And he said, "No, I'm not," because
right,
he didn't even know
right
that his parents had said he was a track
had even
athlete.
Done that, right? Exactly. So,
but I do think
you know,
sorry,
in those cases, there may have been a lot of trust placed on the recommendations of the coaches, so the track coach or the soccer coach or the sailing coach, and you know, at these institutions, and so perhaps there wasn't a system of checks and balances where, you know, the sailing coach said, "Hey, this is a terrific sailor," or the track coach said, "Hey, this is a great pole vaulter," but there was no sort of system of checks and balances that actually opened up the application and looked to see and just made sure that everything checked out.
Natasha, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I do think that the people who are running this scam were aware of this because, you know, for example, there was the actress's daughter who, you know, the father said, "Well, I want to make sure she gets into USC, not just ASU,"
right?
And so those are both great schools, but it's not, I want, you know, to make sure my child gets into Yale rather than, you know, a much lower status university, because I think they recognize, like, the whole story has to fit. And I think there was one example of someone who they said, "Well, your school doesn't have that sport, so we have to switch it to a different sport," and say that you're getting
right
recruited for that. So I think that they were aware of that.
I want to go back to the phones here. Katie from Westford has a thought about the parents' role here. Katie, welcome to Radio Boston. What's on your mind?
Hi. Hi. So I'm a parent of four, and two are in college. One is at UVM and one is at UMass Amherst. And the question that you pose to us as the audience is, how does this make us feel? And I'll tell you, it makes me feel pretty betrayed that there are two sets of rules here, as the mom on board handling homework night after night and packing backpacks and trying to send the message that if you work hard, good things will happen. It's really hard to hear that if you have the money, you can buy yourself in. Someone used the word meritocracy, and I think that that's how a lot of us in middle-class America try to raise our kids. The second point that I'll make is that going through the college admissions process with two boys, we had to deal with the rejection of some elite institutions. And my inner thought when those letters came was, well, if you didn't get in, maybe you don't belong there. Maybe the course material will be too difficult, and you need to go somewhere that's better suited to your abilities. So my question is, what is this? I mean, I understand that this is maybe a fractional, you know, number of people with this amount of money to do this. But what is this doing to the student body of these elite institutions?
Yeah,
if someone doesn't have the credentials to get into Harvard, then how can they handle the course material once they're there?
Katie, you raise some great points, and I really appreciate the perspective as a parent. I want to play one cut here. We spoke earlier with Nadira Farah Foley. She's a PhD student at Harvard, looking at culture, institutions, and society. And she talked about kind of what Katie is talking about there, how we really need to rethink how we value what we value in the admissions process, test scores, extracurriculars, athletics.
When we say that, you know, one type of person deserves to be there and another doesn't, we're reinforcing the idea that the metrics we use for dessert are good and right. I mean, I'm one of those kids, right? Like, I grew up low income, was raised by a single mother, and I was lucky to apply and get into Princeton. And Princeton changed my life. And there was a time in my life where I felt all of those insecurities that, you know, I've seen so many people of color and low-income students sharing their stories on Twitter and talking about all the ways they've been made to feel like they didn't belong and like they don't deserve to be there. And I get it, because I've been there. I'm still there in some ways.
So I want to finish in the time we have left here and just ask you guys about that, because that's really what's at the heart of this matter, is how we decide who gets to go to these schools and the opportunities that going to these schools presents. Maria, I know you work with Top Tier Admissions. That's one of many companies that mm-hmm. helps offer kind of consulting and college essay guidance. You guys, I was just kind of perusing the website. You've got a deferral waitlist analysis program for $8,500, a college essay guidance 5-hour session for $3,000. And you say 95% of your students get into their first or second choice. It's a free market. Respect the model of this is a business. There's a demand for it. This is a service we offer. But do you think at all about kind of how that keeps the divide between haves and have-nots and basically that only one small section of the population has access to those types of programs?
Sure, that's a great question. But actually, before answering that, I wanted just to pick up on something that the last guest was talking about. And one thing that I don't think gets talked enough about in this conversation, and that is what's happening on college campuses in the admissions office to really think about how to create a fairer and more level playing field, recognizing that students approach the admissions process with different levels of resource and opportunity. So I think one thing that isn't talked enough about is how the college admissions process at top colleges and universities around the country is really thinking about how do we create a process that seeks to bring more fairness into a process that is inherently unfair, and thinks about what are the opportunities that students have had available to them, and then how have they achieved relative to the opportunities that they've had. So, you know, I think everybody is kind of shocked and stunned by the news from yesterday with the cheating and the scamming and the gaming of the system. But I do think fundamentally there are a lot of people that are doing this work on both sides of the desk with a lot of integrity, who seek to help students and families understand what this process is all about and how to go about preparing to be good applicants, how to think about learning the life skills.
Totally. And I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're kind of running short on time, and I just want to make sure Natasha has a chance to respond. You know, obviously, there are plenty. It's test prep alone is an $840 million a year industry. There are all these programs out there that many potential students don't have access to. How do you think about equity in higher education?
Yeah. Well, I would take a broader view and say, you know, we live in a very unequal society. American society is more unequal than all most other wealthy nations in this world. And so given that inequality, it is almost impossible to have a truly equitable system, a truly equal opportunities. I don't even know what that would look like. And so because of that, I would say we need to stop putting so much stake in this selection game and recognize that there's always going to be inequality in who gets in and who doesn't. Employers need to recognize that, right? You shouldn't just be recruiting at the top colleges because there are so many amazing people at, you know, non-top colleges, and because it's an unequal system. And so that would be my message.
Yeah, lots more to explore. We'll have to do it another day. That's Natasha Waraku, associate professor at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and author of The Diversity Bargain and Other Dilemmas of Race, Admissions, and Meritocracy at Elite Universities. Natasha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Maria Liscaris. She's a senior private counselor at Top Tier Admissions and was previously director of admissions and dean of admissions and financial aid at Dartmouth College. Maria, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, President Trump orders all 737 MAX 8 and 9 planes grounded. I'm Chris Sitterick, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.